So what I'm going to try to talk about is how we might gain some information about massive stars from looking at high redshift galaxies, as opposed to, you know, what you can learn from any kind of observation in the local universe. And the reason it might be interesting at high redshift in particular is that, well, massive stars rule at high redshift. I mean, you obviously probably think they rule at zero redshift too, or you wouldn't be at this workshop. But at high redshift, they're almost everything that we can observe has to do with massive stars in one way or another, and the influence on the galaxy formation process is very, very strong. Most of the metals come from the massive stars. Most of the feedback processes are driven by things that have to do with either the lifetimes or the deaths of massive stars. And they end up controlling things like gas accretion and how much gas a galaxy hangs on to. And these are all things that matter a lot to people trying to figure out how galaxies form. When you look at anything at high redshift, whether you're looking in the far infrared or the UV or whatever, you're almost always looking at light that came from the massive star population. I think there's a huge kind of opportunity for people interested in massive stars to tell us what's going on. And I'm going to tell you what I think is going on, but obviously my take on things is one of someone coming from left field, and I would be very happy to be corrected or pointed in the right direction. So, all the things we can observe come essentially from massive star populations. And by and large, at high redshift, dust is not as much of an issue at high redshift as it is at low redshift. And there's a certain advantage to having limited detail that you can get from the observations. And essentially, one can say that the same massive stars that you see dominating the far ultraviolet continuum light that you easily see in the optical are also responsible for ionizing the gas and producing the nebular spectra that you can also observe. And essentially what I'm going to talk about today is an attempt to reconcile these two kinds of observations and say, well, if these are the same stars and they're ionizing this gas, these are the properties the stars have to have, and these are the properties the gas has to have to produce what we're observing. Sounds pretty straightforward. I already said the first bullet, essentially. A lot of things that have to do with nebular observations and massive stars are sort of conflated, in my opinion, in the local universe. Simply, you can, for example, assume that the metallicity of the gas being ionized by the stars is the same as the metallicity in the stars themselves. It's not very much of a leap to assume that. The problem is that's true in almost all cases in the local universe, but it will turn out not to be a good assumption. To zeroth order, it's not a good assumption at high redshift, and that's simply because the abundances are non-solar, as I'll talk about. And so the stars care about iron and the nebulae care about oxygen, and they're very different, and so you get weird things happening. That's what I'm talking about. So one would like to separate what's to do with the stars and what's to do with the physical conditions in the gas. And part of that is getting rid of any local calibrations. This is particularly a problem for nebular astrophysics, not so much for the stars, there are certain assumptions built into any nebular measurement, which I'm saying are bad assumptions when dealing with the high redshift universe, even if they might be good assumptions locally. So all the stuff that we've been doing has been motivated by trying to understand what the observations are telling us about massive star populations. Today, I have the more difficult job of convincing you, the massive star experts, that there's something interesting here that's worth thinking about, and maybe encourage some of you to think about how models might be improved to be more applicable to what's being observed at high redshift. All right, so very quickly, I don't want to bore you with things you've seen a million times.
Thank you.
Yes. So blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of star formation at high redshift, as I said. There is this magic redshift range that all ground-based people stuck on the ground for high redshift galaxies know all about. And that's that our the atmospheric windows and the near infrared kind of line up perfectly with the emission lines, the nebulae excited by high redshift O stars. If you focus on a redshift between about 2 and 2.6. So a lot of the stuff I'm going to tell you applies to that. So it's this magic redshift for the near infrared. It's also very, very easy to get large samples. This is just a little 5x7 arc minute field, and every single thing that's color-coded here has a spectroscopic measurement. It's a redshift greater than 1.5, between 1.5 and 3.5, and many of them have both near-infrared spectra and far ultraviolet breast frame spectra. So accumulating samples is not difficult. They're everywhere. You can't avoid them. You just have to get data that are good enough to say something interesting. So all of these things with having to do with the nebular astrophysics are very useful. But the most relevant thing for the direct observations of what's going on with the stars is the far ultraviolet, which you can observe without going to space simply because of the redshift. And this is just an example of a far ultraviolet spectrum of a stack of about 30 galaxies of redshift to 2.4. And it, you know, the stellar spectra are all here. You know, there's lots of stuff to hang your hat on, even at fairly low resolution. This particular spectrum only has a resolution of 1500, but it's surprisingly powerful in comparison to models smoothed to the same resolution for saying something about both the comparison of the wind-based features, comparison of photospheric absorption lines. And I'll talk about that in just a minute. There's also a whole bunch of other stuff here. There's a bunch of these weak nebular emission lines that turn out to be useful diagnostics that are complementary to what you get in the optical part of the rest frame optical part of the spectrum. You get lots and lots of the interstellar absorption features, which I won't talk about a lot here, but it gives you a very interesting handle on the kinematics of the interstellar gas between us and where all the stars are. It basically allows us to measure essentially feedback processes in action.
On the previous slide, you had neon.
Yes.
Right. And in this 30, oh, okay, never mind. It's beyond which you can apply. Got it. Okay.
Can I just ask a question? So
sure.
You still have a problem. Still, if you go into the alignment titanium, that does just drop out of.
Yes, it does. So it, well, okay, it doesn't always drop all the way. And I was going to mention that if I have time. You know, if you go to a little bit higher redshift, you actually get to the Lyman continuum, and you can measure shortward of the Lyman continuum, provided the galaxy allows any of those photons to escape. And of course, that's incredibly relevant to how did the universe reionize. And these are the same kinds of spectra that can be applied to that problem. There's a little bit less information on the nebulae available when you go to high enough redshift to get the Lyman continuum, which is the only reason one starts with this redshift. but I will show some things having to do with what happens when you go higher. Of course, at these redshifts too, you get access to all the gas outside of galaxies, which is interesting for lots of reasons. I won't talk about those today. So let's just focus on that crude cartoon of what we had. So we can look at the stars and we get the far ultraviolet plus various nebular emission lines that happen in the UV, like one in alpha. And we have the nebular emission that we can measure. And we're sort of measuring this for a whole galaxy at once. So this is not quite like looking at an H2 region or even looking at a star cluster, because, and it's actually quite relevant that these are galaxies that have dark matter halo masses of like 10 to the 12 solar masses. They are not, and so they, you know, even in the center parts of the galaxy, the dynamical time scales are tens of millions of years. And anything that depends on time at the million or 10 million year level within some kind of star-forming region is completely irrelevant when averaged over the whole galaxy. So whatever you see in the spectrum has to be happening in lots of places at the same time. So it's kind of an average over lots of time scales that effectively are the time scales over which that it takes for any kind of normal IMF to sort of equilibrate at constant star formation and what the far UV spectrum looks like. And this is, you know, tens of millions of years to 10 to the 8th years or so. So think about that kind of time scale.
Now, is that also, I guess for these, do you really have a specific star formation rate or not?
Yes.
You do.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, typical, the number is 3 inverse gigayears, so it's like 30 or 40 times what a typical galaxy of the same mass would have today. And they're much smaller, so all this star formation is happening in a much smaller volume. But I think it's important to remember that even though the spectra of these things actually look like single H2 regions in many cases, they are whole galaxies. Okay, so when you do look down the barrel at one of these things and you get that for free in the UV, you know, you measure the kinematics, as I mentioned, of the stuff that's coming toward us, and you measure something about the kinematics of the stuff that's going away from us, and the usual sort of P-Cygni-like scattering, you get Lyman alphas redshifted, and all the interstellar lines, which primarily come from stuff over here, give you velocities that go out to about 1,000 kilometers per second for typically, and are very, very asymmetric with respect to the systemic redshift of the galaxy. And you can also see that the Lyman alpha is responding to the velocity of that gas in terms of what its profile looks like. It has nothing to do with the dynamics of the dark matter halo. When you measure Lyman alpha, it's telling you about the scattering medium. And in this case, it's moving fast with large velocities.
That's coming from the stellar winds from the
No, no, that's actually galaxy scale outflows that are driven by, we think, primarily supernovae radiation pressure from the stars. So they are directly related to the massive star population, but not, they probably have very little to do with the winds from individual stars. In fact, the winds are, we think, fairly weak in these things.
And just give us a sense, Chuck, so the typical metallicity.
I'm going to talk, so do you mean iron or oxygen?
Iron.
Iron is about a tenth solar, as it turns out.
Oh, okay.
Typically.
And oxygen?
Half solar, roughly.
That's fine. I think it's just healthy for this.
Yeah,
for this.
I didn't want to say that because it's kind of like taking away the punchline, but that's where it'll turn out, because you don't know any of this until you go through the whole exercise, as it turns out. All right, so I don't need to say anything more about that. Okay, so, you know, this is the part of the spectrum that everybody wants to know about. It's also the part of the spectrum that reionizes the universe, that makes the nebular emission lines, and that we can't observe at any redshift. And so what you do is you use the nebulae that are excited by the radiation field to try to constrain what that has to look like. So you can observe all this part directly, but this has to be indirect. And so
those are models?
I'm sorry?
Those are models from?
Those are models, yeah. And these are all models from Eldridge and Stanway's BPAS suite. They're the ones that I could find that easily, and I've got experience using them. They're all have binaries, but binaries included. And I'll talk about what difference that makes to what we're looking at in just a minute.
But don't local H2 regions also constrain that ionizing flux?
Yes, they do, and they look different in general.
So when you say binaries include, you mean the strip stars, right?
I mean massive binaries. The way I think most of the ones in BPAS or this version of BPAS are actually sort of quasi-homogeneous evolution they're two binary massive stars where
unmodified stars. Basically, each of them evolved as a single star, but they're just as binary.
Yeah, I think, whatever the implementation, I don't know the details of exactly.
No, it's the Peter Eggleton's code. He is transferring mass. There's a mass gain there. He's merging things. There's also strip stars, not with the beautiful spectra that Eva has, but it's pretty okay. So one of the tricks to discuss some point for massive star people is, do we want so many homogeneous evolving stars in there? Because they pop up at the low metallicities. But it's real. It's basically Mesa's code, before Mesa, right?
So,
but it's solving the same equations.
So
not as beautifully as.
Yeah. So I mean, there's good reason to believe that these are ideal environments for the homogeneous evolution to be occurring. They have just the right abundances, and there's other evidence that actually might be very relevant. I'm not gonna presume to tell you anything more about that. I'm going to show you what you have to do if you have an alternative.
Which time do you have this spectrum?
Which?
How old are the?
I'm using 10 to the 8th years with continuous star formation for all of them. And the reason is, as I said, that no shorter time is relevant, because when you're looking at a whole galaxy, and everything kind of equilibrates, and so all the models I'm showing have exactly the same age. They just have different assumptions about metallicity and upper mass limit. And I didn't mean to actually introduce the models in any detail at this point.
Tell what people are passionate about.
So we know that there's something strange going on at high redshift. We've known that for a while. When you compare to local galaxies that are forming stars, we knew 10 years ago that using the usual metallicity indicators, when all you have is strong lines, strong emission lines, it looked like things were quite a bit less metal-rich at a given mass. That's not too surprising. These are much more gas-rich galaxies than their counterparts at low redshift. They also fell in weird places in these nebular diagnostic diagrams, kind of in between where H2 region dominated excitation and AGN dominated excitation would normally fall by the local reckoning. So this has been known, but it wasn't really until one had lots and lots of good nebular spectra that you could see that there was perhaps a bigger problem than one might have been confident about. And that is essentially that. Does it work for me to put a pointer or anything?
Oh, we have a.
Oh, do we?
There's often a pointer, but they tend to walk away.
Anyway, it's okay. So you can see that the ridge line of where all the high redshift, the green, greenish-blackish points are all up here, and they're offset and almost completely disjoint with respect to the sequence of H2 region-dominated galaxies at Z of zero. And, okay, so part of that is change in overall abundances, but it's actually very difficult to explain this just by changing the abundances, because in the local universe, when you change the abundances, it moves things along that sequence, essentially. And this seems to be more of a shift.
Isn't it ionization parameter that moves you along the sequence, and then doesn't abundance move things?
Well, they're one in this. So this is the other problem with all this stuff. These strong line methods rely on various correlations with between reality, that is the real abundances, and ionization conditions. And the problem is that those all depend on assumptions about the ionizing stars in a given nebula, and one would like not to have to make those assumptions and see what you've got. But yes, I mean, there's all sorts of things you can do. But the easiest way to move things in the direction that the sequence seems to move is to change the hardness of the ionizing radiation field at a given oxygen abundance, as it turns out. And so this is, you know, a larger sample, and you can look at different diagnostics, but it's the same problem. Everything is, you know, almost everything is offset from the local relation. You know, there have been quite a few claims that what's really happening is that nitrogen abundances relative to oxygen are very different from the sequence that you have in the local universe, but this, I don't think, turns out to be true. And you can make all of this hang together, and you can see these big points here. I just want to emphasize that those are intended to fall right in the middle of the high redshift distribution, and these are what I'm going to base some of the things that I'm going to show you next. There's stacks of a bunch of things that fall there on these diagnostic diagrams, just to show you that they're representative. This is, to me, it's the easiest thing to look at and notice that there's something really unusual going on. Here's where all the star-forming galaxies in SDSS fall. Here, this is just O3 over H beta versus stellar mass. So you can see at a given stellar mass, O3 over H beta is about a factor of 10 higher in these galaxies than in their counterparts in SDSS.
How do you infer the stellar mass for these?
It's basically just, well, all of these have observations out to 8 microns, observed frame. And so they're the usual SED fits. I mean, they're probably uncertain by 0.2 dex or so, but you know, they're ballpark. They're close enough. So this is a line that was invented in the local universe, Juno et al. To actually divide things dominated by H2 excitation and things that are dominated by AGN, and you can see if that remained true, we got a big problem because all the high redshift galaxies look like AGN, and that isn't what's going on. It's just the spectra resemble or closer to resembling AGN. When you look at, so this is in this diagram, this is essentially ionization parameter in this direction, and this is R23, but I like to think of it as sort of overall, it's the ratio of collisionally excited lines relative to a recombination line. It's kind of an excitate. It's very sensitive to the hardness of the ionizing spectrum in the range of metallicity that we're talking about. And you can see that there are galaxies in the local universe that have comparable values of these parameters, but they tend to be about 100 times less massive. Question?
What is the role of shocks in these things besides the stars you're talking
shocks. About? I think none. I think any effect of shocks are so down in the noise compared to the H2 regions in these objects. You start to notice shocks when all the H2 regions go away. I don't think shocks matter to the observations in this case. But proving that to anyone who loves shocks.
In the meetings, there are different discussions, so I wonder if you're a minority view or if this is...
No, I mean, my opinion is that, when you introduce shocks, you don't even know what that means. Like, what shocks, where shocks, how fast are they? You know, you can do almost anything you want by introducing the right parameters, and so it's kind of like violates the Occam's razor principle to introduce them in things where we have limited question.
I just want to make a 2-cent comment if I can, which is that, I mean, the energy in that ionizing continuum is an order of magnitude higher than like the mechanical energy from the supernovae and stellar winds. So right there it tells you if you're going to like power these lines with the shocks, it's going to be difficult.
Is that always, I was wondering, is that always true? If it's a much more violent star forming region because the whole universe was more violently forming stars, does that still hold?
I think you always
You have to change the IMF somehow, right, to get a lot
No, let's not do that.
Changing the IMF, does that seem even worse than shocks?
Yeah. I mean, that said, there's lots of evidence for shocks.
That's like, Occam's razor death sentence.
Wings and things, okay, but it's small fractions of the total.
Okay,
line.
Thanks.
Yeah. Okay, so the point that I'm going to make later is that you can explain the position in these diagrams simultaneously, but you have to relax some of the assumptions that are normally made when looking at modeling nebular emission. we spent a lot of time scratching our heads trying to understand, why are these things offset? And, people, I have to say, we thought that we were being... let's start at first principles and just use a black body with a certain temperature as the ionizing source. Just let's say we were trying to answer the zeroth order question. Well, what does the radiation field have to look like to explain the nebular observations that we had? So we played around with just using effective temperature as a spectral shape parameter for the ionizing continuum. It turns out that in spite of the fact that we were yelled at by lots of people saying stars don't look anything like black bodies, it's actually not too bad an approximation in the limited range that we're talking about. And there are some lines in there, but they're not very strong at the metallicities that we're talking about. And it looked like you could explain the sequence if you just told all the stars that they had to have they looked in the ionizing continuum like black bodies with temperatures between 55 and 60,000 Kelvin. And whereas if you wanted to sort of use the same simple models to describe nearby galaxies, it would be something closer to 40,000 to explain that part of the... Now, this you should take this with a grain of salt, and this was just meant to indicate that you can actually make a lot of things agree with the observations if you allow yourself the freedom of cranking up the hardness of the ionizing spectrum. And of course, there's been work done in this area, and there are several ideas about how this could be happening. Rapid rotation, which is helped along quite a bit in binary systems, particularly at lower iron abundances, you can easily get stuff that lasts longer and ionizes harder than than you might have expected based on the usual assumptions about single star models. And I should back up and say one of the things that was true, at least when we started all this, is that nobody who was working on galaxy formation models was using anything but single star models. No one. And they were actually using most of them used models that had about 25% of the ionizing photons per unit star formation rate that is actually out there in these galaxies when they were trying to model them. And that is where this hand-wringing about whether there are enough photons to reionize the universe, blah, blah, blah. I think just using the right stellar model gets you...
I'm confused. This is chemically homogeneous single star models. You talk about binaries.
Right. This happens more easily in a massive binary system.
No, it doesn't.
So I mean.
Well, I think if you have binaries, you strip them, and that means that the donor becomes the reprotator, not the loser, right?
Well, no. The idea is that at low metallicity, the less massive star is spun up by accreting mass from the more quickly evolving star next to it, and it spins up because it has very weak winds because it's low metallicity. At least this is what's behind the ideas in the context of the BPAS models.
But it's interesting, right? So what JJ is assuming that at low metallicity, mass gainers and mergers go homogeneous, if I understand well.
Yeah.
And only at low metallicity. I mean, we have that freedom because we don't have the constraints against it. And apparently that's the only way he can get close to the ionizing photons. But it's a pretty extreme assumption. I think that's, for us, something to really discuss. Do we believe
it's extreme in the local universe, but it's totally not extreme.
It's allowed in the distant universe,
because the metallicity only has to have the iron abundance has to be lower than about 0.3 solar, and absolutely everything that we see is lower than 0.3 solar.
My worry or excitement, both, is that we love these models because they can explain a lot of great phenomena, and I'm guilty of part of this. But on the other hand, we don't have direct evidence that this is actually happening. So
okay, well,
we don't, but
we know what I'm going to tell you what the radiation field produced by whatever you want has to look like, and also that it has to make broad helium too that you observe 100% of the time. So those are the two things now. I'm not going to talk about the mass metallicity relation because I don't actually believe it until I know how to measure metallicity, which I don't know how to do until I understand what the ionizing stars are. And so you can do this till you're blue in the face using every single strong line method out there. It's a can of worms. Maybe we can say something more intelligent about it. For now, I think it's safe to say that the oxygen abundances are lower in the high redshift galaxies than things at the same mass. But I think that the abundances of the things that matter to the ionizing sources are much lower. Okay, so here's the idea. You take the same galaxies and you look at their nebular spectrum, and then you look at their far ultraviolet spectrum, and then you say, well, what models can simultaneously look like this and produce a nebular spectrum that looks like that? So let's start with the stars. So, you know, we didn't want to do this as a full-time occupation. We basically all sorts of combinations of single star, Starburst 99 type models, and a bunch of both single star and binary BPAS models at a range of metallicity. And we didn't make any assumptions about what the metallicity of the stars ionizing the gas. We kept the stellar metallicity and the nebular gas phase metallicity separate for reasons that will become clear. And you essentially just do the brain dead thing of comparing these spectra directly to the observations pixel by pixel after smoothing to the same resolution, and you get things that match pretty well. So the only free parameter other than just the overall level of the spectrum is the reddening, and you can use whatever your favorite line of sight attenuation curve or attenuation relation is.
And you assume the normal reddening law, you didn't screw around with that.
We used a few different ones, but there are some ones that everybody always assumes for high redshift galaxies. That's what this is. It's basically reddening the continuum with the Calzetti attenuation relation. If I had, another day, I could tell you why that's probably wrong, and it's closer to an SMC line of sight attenuation curve in reality.
Chuck, why should these models fail so bad for carbon 3?
Because they're not producing nebulae at all. This is just the stars. These were masked out.
Fine.
We're going to treat them separately. Okay. So they actually look really pretty good for the stars.
Just a stellar continuum.
Yeah, so all the things that are dark blue, if you can see it at all, are things that were masked because they have nothing to do with the stars. So this is just zooming in on a few bits of spectrum. And here you can see the usual metallicity dependence of the wind lines. And the different models look rather different, but I would say the biggest difference between the binary models and the single star models is that the binary models predict the broad helium-2 to be there always. And in fact, what we observe is the broad helium-2 is there always. And there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of room for nebular helium-2 in these things at all. It's almost all stellar.
So in that top panel, top right, just maybe walk us through. So the solid, the dark line are the data.
That's correct. Yeah. There's an absorption here, but this broad feature is real, and it's there in every stack that you make of any combination. And in fact, it's very well predicted by the BPAS models. These are all 10 to the 8th years. Continuous star formation.
That same process gives you the kind of broad N5?
No, well, yes. The N5, you can see, is also matched reasonably well, both in emission and absorption. But who knows? I mean, I think that, since we don't know what the nitrogen abundances are relative to anything else, I would take that with a grain of salt. And we're not using the wind lines for anything because we suspect that the things that are dominating those features are not actually in tune with the overall metallicity of the stars, just because they don't depend on the iron. They depend indirectly on the iron abundance. But let me back up. So this is just to show how it varies. If you wanted to ask what is the best fit, it's between about 0.001 and 0.002 for all flavors of models for matching the wind lines. It's closer to 0.001 for the binary models and closer to 0.002 for the single star.
That's the binary fraction?
The binary fraction. It's whatever the...
Sorry.
0.001 is the mass fraction in metals. So on the current abundance scale that I'm assuming, which has a solar metallicity of 0.0142 or something like that, that's about 0.07 solar, 0.001.
Okay. So I see the iron 1608 there, but it looks like a lot.
That's
of
interstellar.
That's interstellar.
Yeah.
So a lot of the power from the stellar metal cities, maybe the carbon 4?
Well, these are all masked. We're all masked in the fitting. Uh-huh. And this is basically just showing you a line that you shouldn't look at. in this comparison.
That's a wind line.
The vertical one.
The vertical. Oh, this
Sorry,
is
how do I tell
all the green. Mess? All the green things. Oh,
blue.
All the green things are interstellar. Green labeled things are interstellar lines that were masked.
Right. So I'm trying to understand that the carbon four is probably part stellar, part interstellar.
The carbon four stellar bit is like this.
Right.
The interstellar bit is down here, and it's actually resolved in these spectra. These are slightly smoothed. You can see the doublet in the interstellar component.
So it's just, I mean, my impression is that there's a significant carbon four stellar component.
Yes.
Is that part of where the stellar metallicity is coming from, or is that mapped out? Okay.
That is noted, but not used for anything for reasons that I'll show you.
Okay.
Is wind clumping included?
Sorry?
Clumping? The winds?
These, to the extent, it depends on which wind prescription was used in which model. Yes.
No, I mean in the spectral analysis, not in the stellar evolution.
In the spectral analysis, no, I mean this is just matching an observed spectrum to a model that includes clumpy winds. And so, not explicitly, there's no,
because that would be important for the mismatch.
Yes, and I'm not trying to match the wind lines because that's more model-dependent than the photospheric stuff. But I'm just showing you what it looks like in these models. So,
So it's hard to see from here, but it's only the lowest in the lower right panel. It's only the lowest metallicity reproducing the helium line, or the?
No.
You can see the orange line.
Yes, that's right. So by the time you get, no, actually, it's weaker in the half solar or 6/10 of solar model, which is the pink, but it's still there in the B-pass models, and it's not there in any of the Starburst 99 models. But what I really want to show you is the next slide, which is meant to show you the differences in iron, photospheric iron abundances. And you can see that you can exclude that these things are near half solar at a very significant level because they would look like the pink spectrum, which produces much stronger line blanketing than the observed spectrum. And in fact, you can quantify that. And essentially, nothing but the two lowest metallicities considered, which is 0.07 and 0.15 solar iron abundances match these spectra. So if I didn't know anything else about them, I would say, okay, well, 10th solar iron is consistent with these spectra, and anything much higher than that isn't. These regions are masked out in this case because it includes a bunch of nebular emission lines. We'll get back to those in just a second. Question.
What kind of galaxies have you here? Is it one galaxy or a stack of galaxies?
This one is based on a stack of 30, all at the same redshift, that have both, for us it's high quality, which means, signal noise of 15 in the continuum resolution of 1500, and they go into a stack. This is based on a stack.
And are they like massive galaxies or?
These are things that have an average stellar mass of 10 to the 10.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And a dark matter halo mass of around 10 to the 12. So these are things that will be large galaxies by the present day, generally.
In this sample, do you also have smaller galaxies or?
Smaller galaxies tend to be fainter, and we're already kind of pushing our luck that we do have some information on things a factor of 10 less massive that, if I have time, I can show. But essentially, it extends these trends, where you could do with some even lower metallicity models for comparison. But interestingly, the nebular oxygen abundances never get very low. Even in the faintest things we've ever observed. I mean, they have strong oxygen emission lines. So they haven't gotten to the point where the nebular abundance of oxygen is so low that you start making the lines weaker. They're sort of at the peak of the strength of those lines, which is interesting. And I'll, if I have time, I'll talk about that at the end. But the point is that you can actually do quite a bit with crappy spectra.
Is the continuum placement here just a smooth fit to the exact spectrum?
So it's just a... this was just really for display purposes. You don't have to fit the continuum because you're essentially trying to match the entire spectrum pixel by pixel. But this is a sort of low order continuum that just to straighten the spectra out for display purposes. But their relative normalizations are the best fit to the spectrum of that particular model.
Right. So that's a real physical model.
Right.
That's a big deal.
I already said this, metallicity greater than 0.2 solar is ruled out at about 3 sigma significance for no matter which family of models you apply. And why does that make a difference? I think a lot of people find it surprising how large the differences among various models, even at fixed oxygen or fixed metallicity, in what the ionizing continuum looks like. And this is not really, this is like preaching to the choir, but when you talk to galaxy people, they always seem a little bit surprised by this. And these are all normalized at about 1,500 angstroms, which is kind of how these things are selected in the first place, based on their rest frame, 1,500 to 2,000 angstrom flux. And this is, so when you're trying to measure reionization, when you're trying to say something about reionization, the normal thing to do is you can measure the luminosity function of galaxies here. And then you make a measurement of this flux, you compare it to that, and you multiply by the ratio, and that gives you the number of ionizing photons you've got. And the problem is that, depending on which model you choose, that the intrinsic ratio of an unabsorbed stellar spectrum differs by a factor of about 3, even at fixed metallicity. And if you use the one, so a lot of people still use in the galaxy business, still use the more than solar metallicity Bruzewell and Charlot 2003 models, which are this dark gray down here. And those things are absolutely hopeless. Ionizing with that spectrum doesn't even come close to matching the nebular spectra. The ones that do match, the one that matches best is this highest one here, which is the BPASS model with binaries, low 0.07 solar with an upper mass limit of 300 solar masses. Now, if you can find another way of getting that same radiation field out of a different model, I think that's important to tell people about, because they're just, for those of us who are relatively incapable of delving into the details of these things, these are the ones that are easily available.
But Chuck, that statement is that you prefer the top red line, that's from
the nebular.
Where you talk about nebula, where you needed where your black body.
Yeah, and I'm about to. I actually haven't shown you that.
It's the same result, right?
So all of these models sort of fit the continuum equally well.
Right.
But then when you ask, do they make the nebular emission lines? That's when things.
So that was the inference you had at 55,000, 60,000.
Yeah, except this is saying, well, now we know what stellar models to look at,
okay,
and we'll put them inside the models.
That's all.
What is the difference between the top two?
That's just the upper mass limit. So in the BPASS models, a single star model that has an upper mass limit of 300 solar masses looks very similar to a binary model with an upper mass limit of 100 solar masses. And that these two curves Those are these two models here. Lois Metallicity Starburst 99 is the purple. That's the single star with 100 solar mass upper limit.
So when you said the helium 2 was, the width was only reproduced with the binary models, that's nothing to do with the binaries. It's because of the high masses, right?
No. No, it can't be. Because the times, so if it were the case, then we would, this model would make helium 2, and it doesn't. The B-pass upper mass 300 doesn't make observable helium 2 for continuous
stuff. So
what
gives the width of the line?
What gives the strength of that?
No, the width.
The width. Well, I mean, it's there because you have stars that produce, that have that feature that last longer than a million years. You know, they last.
The width of the line is the terminal velocity of the winds.
Right.
So
the width is not measured to extreme accuracy, except to say that it's much broader than the instrumental profile. It's a couple thousand kilometers per second full width half max.
So, I don't know which stars do that.
Well, I don't either. In the B-pass models, I know which ones they are, but there might be other possibilities.
So those stars are like Wolf-Rayet spectra. Been attached onto either lower mass strip stars or.
Yeah, but they don't have emission
nodes. They do, because
it's
Wolf-Rayet spectra.
Well, it's not the strip
stars. They're not Wolf-Rayet stars.
These are mass gainers and mergers that are very massive and populating this part of the.
These are not the strip stars.
It's both.
These are not the. Well.
It can be. They have both. Those spectra have these emission nodes.
These don't have metal. These don't have any Wolf-Rayet features other than the helium, broad helium 2. They don't have metal emission lines. Because they're too low metallicity to produce them.
But that's the sign of very massive stars.
Mm-hmm. Right. I won't argue with that. But the thing that's really different about the binary models is you get that spectroscopic signature and it lasts for a much longer period of time. The duty cycle is much longer. And that's what you need when you want the spectrum of a whole galaxy to always have that feature. Because if it doesn't, then you have the occasional star cluster that goes through that phase quickly, but it doesn't amount to anything in terms of the integrated spectrum of the galaxy unless it's there all the time.
And why does that happen in the models? Is that you're always taking stars that started with
it's because all of these things that result from binaries produce longer lasting, very hot stars.
That's from the mass transfer?
It's related to the mass transfer, at least in the B-pass models.
But you're assuming that you only get very massive stars once a million years?
No, I'm not assuming anything. All that's assumed here is a normal IMF with an upper mass limit, and the fact that we're letting continuous star formation for 10 to the 8th years go on. Now.
So that's taken over by a generation after generation.
Yeah.
Just because you're on a long time scale, that doesn't mean things change on a short time scale. I'm not seeing the spectrum, right?
Yeah, it does. I mean, the problem is, you have to imagine, this galaxy has 10 to the 7 O stars in it. So what's happening on really short time scales in a star cluster makes absolutely no impact on the integrated spectrum. It has to be everywhere in order to be seen in the integrated spectrum. And that's the thing that really is the biggest spectroscopic difference that's easily observable between the predictions of the binary models and the predictions of the single star models.
So the lifetime of a feature over the star formation time scale has to be about unity.
Right. So this has to be the rule, rather than the exception, is that the radiation field has to be very hard produced by these stars. And however you want to make that happen, I'm happy with that, as long as it doesn't violate the. And I'm just using the B-pass models because they're out there, and they work. So far, all right, nebulae. So we can actually constrain quite a bit going in. So the thing about nebular modeling, you should take it with a grain of salt, of course. And again, it's a whole galaxy, so it is what it is. But we can measure the sort of average electron density by looking at the ratio of the oxygen 2 lines, which we resolve in the spectra. And it gives you a better number than the sulfur lines do in this range of electron density. It's a few hundred, typically. And this is what the composite spectra, this is the sulfur doublet, and the oxygen doublet is on the left-hand side. So you use that as input, and then you constrain the ionization parameter with the ratio of the... You can either use the neon 3 to oxygen 2 ratio, or you can use the O3 to O2. But this is just the prediction of these various models as a function. And this is the prediction for what, where you get something that produces the observed ratio. And it's a slightly different ionization parameter, because this is essentially a normalization of something that where these things have different shapes. And so you get the ionization parameter that works best is slightly different, you know, which one. But you can see that the observed point is exactly where you would have predicted from essentially all of those models. So we have a pretty good measurement of the ionization parameter. So we have the density and the ionization parameter. And then we can compare it to these nebular diagnostics, the predictions. There's a sort of long, iterative thing that one has to do to get the nitrogen to oxygen abundances right, and this has the result of that in there. Just to jump ahead a little bit, but this is the observed point, and you can see that if you said that the nebular oxygen abundances 0.2 solar, the predictions of the models are way over here, which disagrees very strongly with the observation. Similarly, if you look at sulfur, which ought to be less problematic in some ways than nitrogen, because of course sulfur is an alpha. And I should say that black line is the ridge line for the whole population. And you can see, though, if you increase the nebular abundances to half solar, you get quite good agreement for the highest excitation models. Now, it turns out that the most sensitive measurement is this sort of ionization parameter versus excitation. And it's because the y-axis is sensitive to the normalization of this ionizing spectrum, and the x-axis is sensitive to the hardness of the spectrum. And you can see that the observed point is matched pretty much only by the low metallicity binary models in this case. Not the low stellar metallicity binary models. So the oxygen abundance at which that happens is half solar. So that's the kind of thing that you could never even consider if you're doing this locally, because it's almost always the case that, oh, we know what the abundances are, or at least we know that they're the same, so we put them into the model and you get something that looks totally wrong. But if you don't do that, then you can get it right. With all of the things that we know about, we can make it work. The same is true, I won't bore you with the details, for the nitrogen to oxygen abundance. It could masquerade as a nitrogen to oxygen enhancement if viewed but it actually is something that gets predicted by having this hard spectrum and an oxygen abundance of half solar. It turns out that nitrogen to oxygen is totally normal for its oxygen abundance. You can see again that these highest excitation models do the best job. So what do we do with the UV nebular lines? Well, UV is useful because, for carbon and silicon, for example, and oxygen to some extent. So this oxygen doublet serves the same role pretty much as 4363 does in the optical. It's temperature sensitive. And these lines are lines of the most abundant ions of these elements at for these high excitation H2 regions. So they turn out to be quite useful to constrain abundances, which I will show you in just a second. I don't know why this ended up here, but there's that stellar helium T1640 again.
Stellar hell.
Hell. Yes, it is.
You're stellar. Stuck in stellar.
Yes, that's good. I didn't.
That's the best
comment. And I, you know, using these bits of spectrum, it turns out you can make pretty well constrained measurements of carbon to oxygen and silicon to oxygen ratios. And to cut to the bottom line. Using about 47 different ways to measure oxygen abundances, every one that's been proposed that one could find, it turns out that the electron temperature-based measurement corrected, what a mess. So it turns out that, people who do nebular astrophysics will say that measuring the electron temperature is the gold standard for measuring abundances in H2 regions. And then, oh, by the way, you have to add 0.24 dex to that number to get what you get from the recombination-based, line-based measurements of the same H2 regions. And so it's accurate but systematically off by 0.25 dex. However, if we make the same correction to the electron temperature-based measurement, we get the photoionization models give you the same nebular abundance as the electron temperature-based measurements. So, but you can get all sorts of other things depending on which one you use, and the reason is because these are all calibrated at low redshift, where all the abundances are in their solar ratio, and so you're off. You're off from the truth, wherever that is, by amounts that depend on whether this particular line ratio is altered by the different radiation field ionizing the gas. So, just a summary, iron abundances are about 0.1 solar in the stars, and the nebular abundances are about 0.5 solar in oxygen, and we have measurements of N over O and C over O from the nebulae. Silicon, not unexpectedly, is heavily depleted. And you might ask, well, how does that compare? Well, people, this is probably unnecessary since I've already said it, but we're not saying that the abundances are actually different. It's just that the nebulae don't care about iron. They only care about oxygen. And the stars don't care that much about oxygen. They care a lot more about iron. That's all. And so if you want to make models that match, you have to use different abundances for the stars and the gas. I wish that weren't true. So all of you modelers out there, if you could whip up some models with alpha enhanced.
So I'm sorry. So that's the last sentence I didn't understand. So you actually have distinct measurements. You don't know that it could be the same abundances.
What I'm saying is it's very, very likely that the oxygen abundances in the stars are identical to those that we measure in the nebulae, but the spectra are insensitive to the oxygen abundance.
So what I'm saying is it could be the same exact abundance.
Right. I think that is what I'm saying from a modeling perspective.
It's not scaled solar.
Right. That's right. Well, the way we've arrived at this is by using scaled solar models, using low iron abundance in order to get something that approximates.
Right, but if you plotted up, and maybe you have that. If you just made the old school plot, oxygen on iron as a function of Fe on H. Ah.
You mean this?
Yeah, exactly. There we go. That's the old school plot. Right.
Except I didn't do Fe on H because more relevant is what does it look like relative to O on H.
Well, there's a question you know, that remains, in my mind, at least still open, which is that, you know, we know that type 1A somebody have a young component, for sure. And that if you, and so that gives you a lot of iron at early times. But the question, what we don't know is, when I say young component, do I mean things that come on?
Okay.
So it could be, let me just say it out loud, and then you can, right? So let's imagine I make the hypothesis that, that at 100 million years or 200 or 300 million years, I start getting 1As popping off that increase my iron abundance.
How fast?
That's what I'm saying.
Here's the thing. High redshift galaxy, you know, the usual assumption for anything that's happened since redshift of 1 or so is that, if anything, the star formation rate is a declining function of time.
Sure.
At high redshift, it's an increasing function of time, we think, for most objects, with a time scale of a few hundred million years. And this basically means iron never catches up until after the galaxy starts to fade back down in terms of its star formation rate.
But let me just make the trivial statement. So if you look at what we know about 1A rates in young galaxies, they're one-third of the core collapse rate. And a 1A makes 0.8 solar masses of iron, and a typical core collapse supernova makes 0.05, something like that. So at that rate, the 1As are making more iron than the core collapse supernova. And the question is, what I can't answer, because I don't know, and it may be known, is that at what time do those things turn on, right?
Yeah, so I can't tell you, except that there's no sign of them here. They don't appear to be necessary to explain.
But I'm saying that's how I explain the low iron, is that they haven't turned on yet.
Right, exactly.
Sorry.
No, that's exactly what I'm saying.
Right.
Or things are turned on, but they're always outpaced by the current core collapse supernova.
Right. That's what I'm saying, is that once you integrate over the first giga-year, the iron comes up.
Yes.
Right?
So I have a cartoon that was designed for people scratching their heads who are galaxy people. So the thing is, a few salient things about what we think we know about star formation rates is they're increasing with time at high redshift for a given galaxy. And they have time scales of 200 to 400 million years, depending on how you measure it. And so, with those parameters, you really don't ever expect to see, even if there's iron being produced, it never is produced in the amounts that would compete with the oxygen production rate, until you start to have the star formation rate go down again. And so it depends on what part of this old Nadal plot you are. Just a first approximation. Here's where things are going up. You have very alpha-enhanced metallicity. And the star formation rate at any given time is always much greater than it was a giga-year ago. And that means you see this alpha-enhanced signature. It's in this range between redshifts of 1 or 3 is where this transition is happening. The most massive things are starting to kind of run out of gas. And, you know, I think at that point the iron catches up quickly, and you would expect any stars formed after that peak would not be significantly enhanced. And in fact, you know, if for things that have 10 times the stellar mass of the typical things I'm talking about, that may happen even earlier. And the excitation will go down really fast, and it'll start to look like it ought to relative to what your expectations from the low redshift universe might be. But even at these redshifts, the things that are 10 to the 10 solar masses, that is, they're essentially L-star galaxies at these redshifts, are still dominated by whatever's happening right now. And then, you know, things fade into the universe today, and there's almost no place, or maybe, correct me if I'm wrong, is there any place in the local universe where you have alpha-enhanced massive stars? it's kind of, it's almost like, well, this is why, if you want to understand this, you have to go to high redshift. These environments don't exist now, and they were basically the rule at high redshift.
So this claim has been made for a nearby low-mass star-forming galaxy by Denny Lennon and Mariam Garcia. I can look it up, but...
But it has...
It's not as... Is that right, or am I...
It's the other way around.
Oh, it's the other way around.
Martian abundance is right.
Oh,
and
sorry about it.
Then they claim that the mass rates were wrong, but actually the iron abundance was higher.
I remember.
But the iron abundance, I kind of believe, roughly. But the oxygen abundance, what is the accuracy on that?
I'd say it's uncertain by about a tenth, by about a tenth of a dex, something like that.
I mean, in terms of systematic errors, the whole method, how reliable is the method?
How reliable are your models?
Well, I mean, so you get the same answer, you get the same result from the photoionization modeling and apply, measuring the electron temperature. But that doesn't. But I mean, this is a problem for nebular abundances at all redshifts, and there are systematics in there. But if you use the same assumptions to look at it, I mean, this is what actually was done here. These are local measurements compared to this composite. This is just happens to be. These are just H2 regions in the nearby universe, and this is oxygen abundance from electron temperature method, and this is where the high redshift point and overall you can see it's intermediate. It's in this range where it's increasing very rapidly as you go towards solar megalicity. It's the same for carbon. It falls right in here, and it's in line with the relatively rare environments you can find in the local universe where...
Let me try to frame my question differently for a minute. Okay. See. So if you ask the question of where can I best make measurements, nuclear synthetic yields that just have massive stars in the yields, what's the best environment you can find? What do you think it's...
High redshift. Things that are very blue and dominated by current star formation at high redshift will have those.
So I mean, to me, that's another sort of fundamental maybe way of addressing what you're saying, is that that's the environment you're in. I mean, there's the question is, how do we actually know what the nucleus synthetic yield is for a population of massive stars, right? It's always been done in this integral constraint rather than a direct measurement.
There are lots of questions that are like, well, are the yields different if you start with non-solar abundance ratio?
No, I understand that. Yeah, I understand that.
I just,
This may be a good environment to make that measurement.
But you probably have to be in the X-rays, I think. I mean, people have tried this with Chip Kolomnicki's thesis 2 decades ago. We're looking at, in dwarf irregular galaxies locally, little regions with, Wolfram-A stars, and looking at differences in the chemical abundances of the nebulae with location and age of the star cluster. And miraculously, they were all the same and showed no evidence of enrichment, recent enrichment from the massive stars. And the conclusion was that the metals all go directly into the hot phase. You can't see them at 10 to the 4K.
Well, I mean, I think the problem is that the nebulae, I think that I wouldn't believe any nebular measurement of any kind that made by anyone.
I'm
serious. I mean, when you look at the details, there's no reason to believe them, except as a sort of indicative. Because you could explain all the spectra that I was showing by monkeying with relative abundances and saying, the problem is that there's only. There are lots of ways to do it, but you'd like to have a way that seems internally consistent to achieve that. And so far, I think what I've been talking about is the only way I've seen of doing this in an internally consistent way, but there could be other explanations. And you can see that this sort of estimated oxygen to iron in these things is as extreme as anything in any stars in the Milky Way. There's a recent publication of an old stellar population at redshift 2 that has the same kind of alpha enhancement, which this is a galaxy that was just pretty much finished by, you know, the redshifts where we're looking at things that are in, you know, forming the bulk of their stars. And that, you know, I guess that means it was something that formed so rapidly that again, these type, short timescale 1As. I mean, how secure is that whole business of short timescale 1As?
I think there's no doubt that there's a piece that knows about this, the current star formation rate. I mean, that's the piece that's secure. What is less secure is the time delay.
Could it be just different iron yields for the masses, for the core collapse?
And this is observed events.
Yes, these are
okay. I
yeah,
see.
Yeah. I mean, these are data.
But, okay, so, and the age
is... It's not a population, so this is data.
Oh, and you're saying that it knows about the current star formation rate. Is that what you're...
I'm saying if you just look at spiral galaxies, yeah, and you can see that there's a clear 1A population that's roughly one-third of the core collapse rate. You can also... There's other ways of doing it, but there's multiple examples. You know, the 1A rate rises with redshift.
But how do you know how old those progenitor stars were?
What I'm saying is that they're just not, it's not, the old story for 1As was that, you know, they're all giga years, they're only, right, I can't answer the question, is it less than, is it 100 million years or 500 million years? I can't answer.
And does this happen at all, metallicities?
As far as we know.
Yeah, but do we know much about low metallicity environments for that kind of thing?
We'd have to do a galaxy sample, I don't know.
I mean, I think...
So one of the most direct evidence, I don't know the answer to that question, but one of the nice evidence for this delay time is also coming from the remnants in the Magellanic Clouds, where you can age date the stellar population. It has other issues with it, but you can look at type 1A remnants and look at the surrounding age population, and you see a relatively young population.
So I think what's interesting to me is that, I mean, that's, I guess the question is, you know, one may be able to interpret your result is that you are just getting the pure core collapse rate.
Well, that's what I think is most consistent.
You know, and therefore, if you really think it's a 100-million-year-old system, I would have to say the 1As can't do anything in 100 million years, which is...
Well, I mean, it could be a 400-million-year-old system whose star formation rate has been increasing the whole time.
Sure, fine. Okay.
So how long does it take between a 1A and for that gas to rain down and cool enough to form stars? That is not right after, right?
You've got short inhalable times in these systems.
Well,
I can't do
so it depends where the gas goes in the meantime.
So 1As would go off in more empty environments shoot it out further.
Tracking star formation.
Yeah,
but, you know, I think the point, at high rich, the point is no matter how you do the 1As, they've got a much longer time scale than the alpha elements do. And if the star formation rate is increasing with time,
right.
You know, no matter what, they just can't catch up until things settle down a bit.
Right, so I think the main message is that don't think that 1As only come in at a giga year or longer. That's, I think, the message.
Right, I understand. I mean, it's just a hand-wavy kind of number that one uses, you know, that...
The other takeaway, if you can tell the difference between 100 million years and 100 million years for when they go up, that's really interesting to some people.
Yeah, so ages of galaxies I think it's impossible to believe those numbers too. They're so dependent on what you assume about the star formation history, especially for these kind of spectra. You're essential. It's worse than measuring a star formation rate just by measuring a few massive stars and extrapolating over the whole mass function. It's basically the mass to light ratio all the way out through the rest frame infrared is extremely low, and so, you know, the stellar mass in the thing is not really constrained by any direct observation. It's a tail wagging the dog kind of thing.
Chuck, we got about 5 more minutes. I'm not sure.
I have a couple of summary slides, but.
So, I mean, to me, the thing that made the higher iron abundances just not work
was it seemed like at this resolution it kind of depressed.
Right, I agree. It's
So one just worries a little bit, you know, is there any trade-off between like the REDMI law and fitting the stellar model that could, you know, could we be wrong enough about the REDMI?
I'm not imposing any particular assumption about the REDMI, just making it, putting in whatever reddening is needed to make it match the closest it can possibly match. Now, it doesn't make much difference which reddening law you use. That was just a cheap and easy way of producing, you know, a range of realistic things that could possibly match the shape. I mean, the shape match is very good. In fact, that those same models work very well for where you can see the Lyman continuum. This is the same B-pass model, the orange spectrum, and it's been reddened, line of sight reddening, and it had the IGM correction put in, and you can see that the agreement is good across.
So you're fitting over that whole range.
Yeah.
Okay. So you started out discussing the spectra and the stellar population models behind, which are binaries, turn and solar mass stars, whether you believe that's and how that's done. It's a different story, but one ingredient that's still missing in this, and I wonder if it's of any importance or not, is I don't think any of these models puts an X-ray component from X-ray binaries. I wonder if that's has any effects on the surrounding clouds that you would pick up on? Are we safe to ignore this?
Well, I think they would have minimal effect just because they, you know, they have their mean free path is so much longer.
I know that, but is that still true? Dense clouds.
I think that X-rays, I don't know, you know, I'd have to look at the fine print for Starburst 99. It might already include X-rays.
No.
But, yes, X-rays are always the last refuge of the scoundrel when it comes to producing ionization magically that you don't see.
There is a clear prediction from these models how many X-ray binders there would be at that point, and you can also calibrate it against observation.
Yeah, so that has been done to the extent that one has used X-ray observations of these galaxies and asked, does it give you the same star formation rate under the usual assumptions as H alpha does? And the answer is, as close as you can measure, yes. But and so they are there. I guess it's another very model dependent issue. What the X-ray net X-ray spectrum of X-ray binaries would look like, and would local examples be good templates in this case? I'm not sure, but I agree that, you know, it's another source of ionizing photons, and it could actually, it would have a large scale effect on the gas phase in these galaxies if it's important.
I mean, I agree it was not the top of our priority list, but I think we're working down to asking questions about all these different
things. So it's one of these things that doesn't seem to be necessary to invoke to get something that hangs together, which of course doesn't mean that they're not important.
Well, now you need homogeneous stars.
I don't think
you need that for the helium. Well, we can discuss, but
It does make, maybe I should ask the question, well, what should one be looking for in the spectrum of these things that would be, that would give you significant constraints on what the actual stellar populations are doing, other than what I've talked about already?
Helium-2 emission.
Helium-2 nebular emission.
No.
Oh, well, I mean, we have that, but you can see it's a low contrast feature in the integrated spectrum, but it is always there, and it is. I haven't done this exhaustively, but it's present in a continuous star formation model if you have binaries included in the with the prescription that JJ uses in BPAS. And it isn't there in the Starburst 99 models with the stellar models that are built into that.
But that's because those models are not complete.
Because they're spiders.
So let me one final question. So you didn't tell us how many kryptonites.
These composite spectra were done in about eight nights, but you know, knowing what to, but of course we had to build the instruments that were used.
Well, it's more a question of what samples are coming. So this was 30. Everything you showed.
I've got about 150 now of what I've, and the idea is that, you know, it would obviously be more interesting if you could stack things as a function of properties, so you can understand if there are any trends you can pull out.
I think for this crowd, it's important to know what's coming.
Yeah, and this is not going to be helped very much by JWST, but it can tell JWST what they should be thinking about the spectra that they are observing, because really it's just going to be the nebular spectra, and if you don't know what the underlying stars look like, you know, you'll just be flailing like people have been.
Thank you.